This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. From constellations to meteor showers, it's a great time of the year to go stargazing. Stephen O'Connell spoke with astronomy professor at Pitt Community College on what to look for in the autumn night sky.
Well, the sky is always changing, which is kind of the neat thing about it. It's not static per se. Now, the stars, the relative position of stars are going to be the same with each other. But if you go out on any given night, the position of the stars at a particular time are going to move approximately 1 degree per night. You know, now, the planets, they're always changing their relative position with the stars. And so they're moving around all the time.
Is there anything that is stable in the night sky?
The only part of the sky that doesn't change, that's the same all year long, are the region of stars that are pretty near the North Pole. And those are what are called circumpolar stars. You know, the Big Dipper is in that group. Cassiopeia is in that group. Cepheus is in that group. And those are stars that never set.
Is there anything to be looking out for that's, you know, exclusive to this part of the year?
Well, the fall is a really nice time to do astronomy because, you know, especially here in eastern North Carolina, because, you know, we tend to get, in the summertime, a lot of haze in the sky with the humidity and stuff and cloudiness, and we tend to have more clear nights during the fall and winter months. I like the late fall because it's not really so frigid cold. You know, this time of year, you can see the summer triangle setting at sunset. The Great Square of Pegasus is going to be almost directly overhead.
Can you tell me about some, like, really great locations you found in eastern North Carolina for looking up at the sky?
The best thing to do is get out of town. You know, if you're inside of one of the bigger towns, it's hard to see a lot of things. If you can just go a few miles out of town, you'll really improve your vision. But if you're fortunate enough to live in a rural place, which a lot of us are, you can go out in your backyard and see a lot of things. You know, the big thing is just get away from as many lights as possible.
How about telling us about some events that are particularly spectacular in the night sky before 2012 is over, or some objects that we can see particularly well?
During the month of November, if a person wanted to go out, they would be able to see Jupiter and Mars in the evening, and they could be able to see Mercury and Venus and Saturn in the mornings. You know, so there would be an opportunity to see the five planets that the ancient Greeks knew about this month. You know, when you're talking about, you know, things to do as a family, the nice things, I enjoy looking at meteor showers. Those are things that are kind of hit and miss. Sometimes they're really exciting, and sometimes they're a nice time to go and stand in the dark and talk to your families while you're looking up in the sky.
Can we expect any meteor showers in the coming months?
Leonid meteor shower is November. It peaks in the wee hours of November 17th, so the evening of November 16th through 17th is the best time to do it. 3 a.m. is the peak. The Geminids is December 13th and 14th. The night of the 13th is the best time, and it's more family-friendly, so it should be really nice for people to observe between 9 and 10. But it peaks also again about in the early morning. Quadrinids are in January. First through fifth is when it happens and peaks of the third. Okay, it averages up to 40 meteors per hour at peak.
Professor Goodman, what exactly distinguishes a meteor shower from all the other space junk we hear about that is flying by us every day?
Now, if something is called a meteor shower, that's where you're getting a whole lot of things that'll be coming down at the same time. And a whole lot of means more than five per hour. And they'll be kind of appearing to come out of the same region of space. And that's what we call, you know, that point in the sky where they seem to radiate out from, that's what we name them for. But the nice thing about meteor showers, observing them, is you don't need any equipment. All you need to do is go out and look with your eyes and keep looking up, and you will see them.
Professor Goodman, if I wanted to make looking up at the night sky a regular habit of mine, a weekly habit, what kind of advice would you give me to begin that process?
The best thing to do is join a group of people who already know what they're looking for. And there are several astronomy groups in the region. You know, that's what I would suggest.
Is buying a telescope a good option?
Don't go out and invest in a telescope to start off with. You know, if you're going to start looking at things, start off by using a nice pair of binoculars that you might also be able to use for other things. And start, you know, go out, learn the constellations, you know, and you can buy a device called a constellation wheel, which can help you find which constellations are up at any moment, or go on the internet and you can actually print out what the night sky looks like at any given time. If you can do that, then you go out and you start looking for planets and find out where these planets are, and you can start watching how the planets move through the sky over the, you know, over the year.
Professor Goodman, I appreciate you making some time for us today.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, the temperatures are dropping, and that means if you haven't already had them, you'll be getting frost warnings soon, and then freeze warnings. If you have a vegetable garden, you need to really pay attention to these, depending on what you have planted out there. And we'll talk about those plants later. Let's talk first about the difference between a frost and a freeze. In order to talk about those, it's helpful to think about how warmth and coolness works on the Earth's surface. During the day, the sun shines down on the soil and plants and warms them up. And then at night, that warmth radiates away from the plants. On a really still night, when there's no wind, you actually can have plants that lose heat faster than the air around them. As a result, the plant's surface can freeze, even if the air around it is slightly above a freezing temperature. This is what happens in a frost. Now, anything that keeps that warmth from radiating away from the plant surface can prevent the frost. That's why, on a night with a heavy cloud cover, you don't get a frost. Only on a clear night with no clouds to hold that warmth down. You can also stop the heat from radiating away with some type of cover over your garden, whether it's built like a little greenhouse cover or just a floating row cover, light fabric that you place over your plants. Either one may prevent frost. So now we understand frost. What's the difference with a freeze? Well, a freeze is actually a large air mass of below freezing temperatures moving into the area. It generally comes with winds more than 5 miles an hour, and it is usually much thicker cold air above the plant surface. And you get an actual deep freeze of the plant tissue rather than just a coating of frozen moisture on the surface of the plant. Well, what happens? How does a freeze kill plant tissue? First of all, remember that the plant is made up of a lot of water, and there's water inside each bit of that plant. When the water inside freezes, it causes ice crystals that pierce the cell walls of the plant. And then when the temperature warms up, the cells leak out their fluids and the plants die and turn to mush. Here in coastal Carteret County, our average first frost date is November 19th. It's different right here on the coast, where water tends to temper our climate a little bit. Just a short ways inland, that first frost will often come sooner. The first freeze here in coastal Carteret, between December 4th and December 17th. But remember, these are average dates. Mother Nature doesn't pay attention to our charts, and you can have a very late first frost or freeze or a very early one. Pay attention to the warnings in your area. And if you have crops that need to be protected in your vegetable garden, now's a good time to think about getting the materials to protect them. However, don't think that you can protect summer vegetables with a simple row cover out in the garden. If you still have tomatoes or peppers or eggplant, beans, any of the very, very tender vegetables, be sure you harvest them before that first frost hits. If you have lettuce or other vegetables that are very tolerant to cool temperatures, if not heavy freezes, those are the great ones to protect, to extend the season, and keep them growing throughout the winter. Other vegetables, like kale and collards, all of the hardy winter vegetables, and there's a lot of them here on the coast, they go all winter long without needing any help from you. We just don't get cold enough to cause them much damage most years. Sometimes you'll get a little freeze damage on the leaves, but the plant keeps going. So pay attention to the frost and freeze dates now that you know the difference. Take care of what you need to in your garden, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This weekend, the historic Old Theater in Oriental will be transformed into an old-time radio set with actors, sound effects, and a live studio audience. The Big Guns, or Whose Little Lily Is She, is a comedic salute to the golden age of radio.
Lily comes in from out west.
And she has a purpose, and her purpose is to find who her father is.
And so the two men,
either Reddy John or Big John, are her father or someone else.
And, of course, you've got to have the drama. She gets kidnapped. They have to go after her.
The story includes a surprise ending. Director and Vice President of the Old Theater Corporation, Lynn Whalen.
This year we decided to go with Westerns and do the rootin' tootin' and the stagecoaches coming in and the horses and everything.
The story unfolds in the fictional radio studios of WONC, which stands for Oriental North Carolina. The cast of about 15 actors are on stage dressed in 1940s Western gear, including cowboy hats, boots, and old-fashioned dresses.
Good evening, listeners everywhere, and welcome to the Oriental Radio Theater of the Air. This is your host, Raymond Edward Collins.
If you hear a loud splash or boom during the show, it's most likely Ellen Special dropping bags of sand, punching a baseball glove, or clanking plates and silverware. She's in charge of creating the sound effects during the broadcast. She's surrounded by microphones and a large table covered with random objects like boots, a hammer, and a bucket of water.
Somebody is falling into a creek. Well, actually, after they've fallen into the creek, they're wading in the water. So we do this to sound like wading. Of course, there's opening the door and closing the door. Footsteps.
Not all of the sound effects are live. Thanks to technology, more complex sounds, like horses galloping and neighing, originate from a CD player in the production booth. The cast includes a diverse group of people ranging in age and experience. Rich Tuttle is a youngin' in his acting career. He plays Sheriff Baker.
It's also kind of an actor's paradise, mainly because it's a radio show, and we get to read our scripts. So I think all of us are loving that part of it.
Especially Will Wheeler, an 8th grade student at Pamlico Middle School. He plays four different characters during the production. Even though the actors don't have lines to memorize, sticking with the script presents challenges of its own.
You don't have a lot of the movement. You're just kind of standing there in front of Mike, and that's the hardest part for me is like to just stand there and kind of want to move and do the actions.
Will's sister, Emma Wheeler, is a senior at Pamlico High School. She plays Abigail Crump. She's been acting for 14 years.
I definitely agree with that. I'm used to memorizing my lines as quickly as possible, so I'm off book and I'm free to move about. And with this show, we're confined to our script. We have to use our script. And it is more freeing than I thought it would be because you get to do a lot with your voice that you wouldn't otherwise maybe get to do.
It was then that Deacon Adderley walked up to me and started stammering.
Sheriff, did you hear that?
Well, yeah, I ain't deaf.
Well,
what?
We can't have a situation like that in a decent community like this.
The Old Theater's production of The Big Guns, or Whose Little Lily Is She, takes place tonight at 7:30 p.m. in Oriental. Director Lynn Whalen says the performance is rated PG-13.
There's a couple items that are probably language-related that you would have expected out in the rough Wild West.
If you'd like more information, visit the ENC Events Calendar section of our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Crystal Coast Civic Center, Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront, business meeting, and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center, 252-247-3883.
Been having a little bit of a bad week?
And he is passing you off to a giant squid. You are part of some sort of food chain, my gosh.
Maybe you're feeling a little blue.
General sense of malaise, kind of.
How come you never mentioned this to me?
Wasn't sure how to pronounce it.
Well, we've got just the thing for you.
Made from whole wheat that gives shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done.
Join us this weekend, won't you?
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evenings at 6 on PRE Public Radio East.
This is the Downeast Journal. The First Order Fresnel lens that lit the original Cape Hatteras Lighthouse has imposing dimensions, 12 feet high, 6 feet wide, and a weight of 6,000 pounds. Something not easily misplaced, and yet it was missing for 140 years until a Raleigh author and documentary filmmaker became intrigued with the mystery, courtesy of an unassuming 17-word sentence. George Olson has this, which originally aired in June 2003.
It is the funny thing about obsession that it can have the most mundane beginnings.
I have removed the First Order apparatus from the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse to a good storehouse in the county and had it safely stored.
Author Kevin Duffus, reciting from memory a single sentence from a letter written in April of 1862 by Dr. David Talo, a Washington physician, and sent to Confederate States of America Chief of the Lighthouse Bureau Thomas E. Martin. Obsession might be too strong a word. Duffus actually misquotes the letter, though not enough to change its meaning. But for whatever reason, it was that sentence that fueled Duffus to answer a question that had remained unanswered for 140 years and resulted in his new book, The Lost Light.
That was the last published historical record of what happened to the Hatteras lens 140-some years ago. No one knew what happened to it. I mean, it was considered lost. In fact, the president of the American Lighthouse Foundation, Tim Harrison, has called it the greatest unsolved mystery of American lighthouse history. And what happened to the First Order lens from the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse?
The original Cape Hatteras Lighthouse was first lit in 1803. New lighthouse lenses were installed periodically to better aid ocean-going traffic around Hatteras's hazardous shoals, culminating in 1854 with the installation of a First Order Fresnel lens manufactured by Henri Lepeau and Company of Paris, France. The installation of the Henri Lepeau lens at Cape Hatteras indicated the importance the U.S. government placed on the Hatteras Lighthouse. There were literally hundreds of lighthouses in America, but the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse became one of only about a dozen at that time with this top-of-the-line apparatus. But the lighthouse went dark in 1861. The Civil War was about to start, and North Carolina's governor ordered the shuttering of coastal lighthouses to frustrate the Union Navy. Lighthouse lenses were disassembled and removed, and the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse lens was no exception. It made its way to Washington, where Dr. Talo came in possession of it, spiriting it away to an unknown storehouse in Granville County, and then, no one knew, though not from lack of trying. Duffus recounts research done in the 1970s when he was a teenager looking for information about a wreck he dove in Chicago Creek near Grimesland.
Now I knew it was from the Civil War, and I went to the East Carolina Library and did some research and eventually found in the records of the War of the Rebellion a letter written by a Union lieutenant in March of 1862, describing the federal invasion of the town of Washington and the peaceful capitulation of the town. But the very first thing that the Union lieutenant asked for when he stepped foot on the town wharf in Washington is, we're here to get the lens from the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse.
Duffus came to believe that the search for the lens during the Civil War had great symbolic meaning for the Union, that the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, like the Union, would not be extinguished. Troops searched for the missing lens, and its whereabouts drew the attention of high-ranking officials in the U.S. government.
One of the things that pointed me in that direction was I found a letter that had been written by a New York law firm located in Manhattan in 1862. This is a law firm that was noted for their work on government patents and railroad matters. But this letter was written to the head of the United States Lighthouse Board in Washington, D.C., asking for the name and address of the keeper of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse who participated in the removal of the lens. I thought that was rather interesting. Why would this big patent law firm be interested in this poor man who had a government job out on the Outer Banks. And what I later found out was that the law firm was owned by William Seward. He was one of the principal partners. And William Seward, of course, was Secretary of State under President Lincoln. And Seward had been conducting this campaign against those people he considered traitorous to the United States government, and certainly a lighthouse keeper paid with federal funds who helped steal the lens from his lighthouse and then later hide it would be among those people that Seward would be searching for.
Duffus's search for the Hatteras lens was much like the Union search, not always fruitful. Both the modern-day researcher and the Civil War-era U.S. government at times worked under the assumption their efforts had resulted in a hoped-for outcome.
Now, in the course of my research, I ran into one hairpin turn after another, and one of those was that I discovered a document that stated that when Sherman's army captured Raleigh in April of 1865, soldiers discovered in the rotunda on the second floor between the House and Senate chambers a vast pile of lighthouse illuminating apparatus. So throughout the entire war, they've been searching for all these lenses, and they get to Raleigh, and there they are right in the middle of the Capitol. You can imagine our state's legislators doing their business and basically tripping over these crates and boxes and pieces of glass.
A first-order Fresnel lens was discovered among the crates and boxes, but the problem was there were two first-order lenses in North Carolina, and what Union soldiers had discovered was the Cape Lookout Lighthouse lens, not the coveted Cape Hatteras lens. So the Union search, and Duffus's, continued on. But the Union did ultimately find the lens, and so did Duffus.
One thing I've learned through this entire process, of course, is the importance of perseverance, persistence, and the fact that when you're looking for something, at the very moment you're ready to give up, that's usually when you find it.
Which was precisely the case for Kevin Duffus. He had been actively searching for the lens for 2 years, but real-life constraints, earning a living, were causing him to consider wrapping up his search.
I had promised myself and my wife I would just make, you know, one more trip to Washington. We were beginning to worry about whether I was going to, whether I had wasted all this time, and I really needed some way to turn this into a way to generate income. And literally at the last minute, I mean, with 10 minutes left on my last day in Washington, it was 8:45 on a Thursday night, and National Archives closes at 9:00 on Thursday nights. And I was just about ready to concede defeat that I had not been able to solve this. And I turned one last page. I had been looking all the past 2 days through letter books written in the 1860s and early 1870s. And I had gone through thousands of pages of handwritten documents and letters, and I decided to just turn one more page, and there it was, this letter that was written in 1870, actually, that told me what happened to the Hatteras lens.
And he found it. On the day we spoke, he had actually brought a section of the discovered lens to display for me.
This is a prism from what is called the upper catadioptric panel. This was used to bend the light from the center of the lens out into a flat plane or sheet that could be seen anywhere from 18 to 20 miles off of Diamond Shoals and Cape Hatteras.
In the course of our conversation, Duffus never revealed where the lens ended up after the Civil War or where exactly it came to rest when he discovered it. So I'll honor his unspoken request to keep the mystery section of the Lost Light alive, though I'll go so far as to say that if you've ever looked for your glasses and found them on top of your head, you can probably figure out where the lens went after the Civil War. And for where Duffus actually found the lens in 2002, think the closing minutes of the film Raiders of the Lost Ark. But its future location is no mystery. The First Order Fresnel lens of the 1803 Cape Hatteras Lighthouse will eventually be on display at the graveyard of the Atlantic Museum at Hatteras Village. And when it is reconstructed, you won't have to look far. It will be part of a major exhibit in the entrance of the museum. No search required. The Lost Light, The Mystery of the Missing Cape Hatteras Fresnel Lens by Kevin Duffus, is published by Looking Glass Productions. I'm George Olson.
Malibu was
dark forest green,
a purple four-door.
He was a burgundy maroon, and the insides matched. And my car
is making great radio.
Fresh air.
Morning edition.
Car talk.
Wait, don't tell me.
Weekend edition.
And that's awesome.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at our website, publicradioeast.org. Just look for the Newshound link.